While some of you may be experts in one kind of plant, like roses or daylilies, most of us have a little bit of everything in our gardens, plus maybe a lawn as well. Well, we're lucky to have such a great group of UW Extension horticulture educators in our state. They answer any and every type of question you can imagine and do it with a smile. Hi, I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Today we have Patty Nugai here to help. Patty's a UW Extension horticulture educator for Racine County and has lots of great information to share. Patty, always great to have you with us on Garden Talk.
Thank you. I'm always happy to be here.
And it's feeling a little springy out there.
It is. There are puddles, all kinds of melting snow, and I can see patches of grass. Doesn't look so great,
but it's there.
But it's there. There really is something under the snow, so I'm happy to see that.
I can see my raised beds. They're not completely buried right now.
I can't see mine yet.
Soon,
mine are still completely under snow.
Really? Wow. Well, first of all, Monday is St. Patrick's Day, and there are a lot of fun shamrocky plants around right now. Are those nice plants to have?
You know, there's one that makes a really fun little interior plant, and it's an oxalis, actually, but it is a beautiful little green trifoliate leaf, so it has those three little leaves, and it has three little leaflets on the one leaf and the little white flowers, and it's so dainty and delicate. Makes a great little gift plant. And they can last quite a long time in the house if you take good care of them.
What kind of care do they need?
They need sort of regular moisture. They don't like to go completely dry. They need bright light, but not direct sun. They do perfectly fine in a bright room. They can be used as a really pretty centerpiece, like on your kitchen table or something. They're just a fun little plant to give as a gift or to receive.
And am I remembering that I've seen a variety of those that have kind of a reddish purple leaf too?
Yeah, there is one. And in fact, you may have seen it as a weed in your yard. Because there
one person's weed is another person's plant.
There is a form of that red-leaved oxalis that if it escapes into your lawn, especially the shadier parts of your grass, it can be quite a lovely little weed.
So is that just the red variety, or could we plant the green outside?
I'm not sure if the one that they sell in the garden center is truly hardy here, but they do. They're pretty heavy seed producers, and I'm not sure that you would want it in your yard.
So maybe keeping it as a container plant?
Keeping it as a house plant is a great idea. You know, that's how ground ivy, the lovely little plant with the purple flowers, got into our yards through a purposeful introduction in hanging baskets.
Oh, dear.
Or use as a ground cover. Mm-hmm. And it, of course, is a fabulous ground cover.
And if we want to keep that shamrock plant, the oxalis, going, does it need fertilizer other than that bright but indirect light?
Not much, because it is a of course, in the legume family. It's a Fabaceae, so it produces, it actually grabs nitrogen from the air. And with all things along the line, if you over-fertilize it, you'll get luxurious foliage, but you may not get such great flowers. So a little bit of a balanced approach would be necessary to keep it going, as with all houseplants. Of course, anything that's containerized will need to be fertilized at some point, but too much is not a good thing. So it's very important to follow the recommendations on the individual fertilizer that you select and make sure that you're choosing one that's specifically for flowering plants, and you'll find that those will be a little bit lower in nitrogen.
And I did do a little research, and we should let pet owners know that according to the pet poison hotline, the oxalis plant, or the shamrock we're talking about, can be mildly to moderately toxic to dogs and cats, but that the leaves have such a bitter taste that generally it deters pets from eating them.
I would like to think that all poisonous plants are that way. You know, that one little taste and you go, oh, that's yucky, and they won't eat it. But, you know, unfortunately, a lot of our houseplants are poisonous to dogs and cats. Mm-hmm. Most of them are only mildly toxic, to the point that they would probably just make them throw it back up. But some of them are deadly. Mm-hmm. You know, anything in the lily family, deadly.
Right.
To cats especially.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think part of it is knowing if your pet is a chewer or not.
Right, and not all of them are. I have a dog who mostly leaves all of my plants alone except for one plant. And every now and then, very infrequently, and I don't know if it's because he has a little tummy ache or what the deal is, but he will chew on my hibiscus.
Huh.
I don't know. I tried to ask him why he's doing that.
And he's just not forthcoming with an answer.
No.
We are talking with Patty Nagai. She is the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County. Always has lots of great information to share, and I'm sure today is no exception. You can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Jennifer Dargan, our on-air producer today. And Patty, we had a request a couple of weeks ago, a caller who was going to be gardening for the very first time ever. Mm-hmm. It sounded like had not even done it as a kid, you know, along with a parent or something. And she was hoping for some really great basic advice for getting started. And when you and I talked about it, we also thought that that could serve as a great refresher for experienced gardens too. So let's start with some of those really basic basics. And I'm guessing that most of these will really apply for either fruits or veggies. You can let us know if that's not the case. But I think one thing that all of us can benefit from is thinking about how large a garden to take on.
Right. And, you know, that is one of the basics that I always share with new gardeners is try to keep it small the first year so that you can bask in your success and not really fret over failure, because it's no fun to fail. And you can grow the garden during the season. You can grow it in the next year, but start small so that you can learn more about your own yard, your own garden, and what you like, you know, what you really want to accomplish. So if you're looking to beautify your yard, you might even want to start with just a container and go for a large container. You might want to look at something that is 20 to 24 inches in diameter. That's like a little miniature garden. And then talk to your local garden center where you're going to purchase your plants and make sure that you're selecting the plants that suit the site. So a container can be moved, of course, but you probably have an idea of where you'd want to put it. That place has conditions. Mm-hmm. Is it subjected to wind? Is it high light? Is it low light? Does it get more than 6 hours of direct sun a day? Does it get less than 6 hours of direct sun a day?
And I think for people who might be working during the day most days of the week, they may not be
aware of that. Yes. And people struggle with that a little bit. And we really want you to succeed. We want you to make some good choices. It's always great to learn from your mistakes, but gosh, it would be great if we didn't make any mistakes at all, wouldn't it?
Right.
So understanding the light and the conditions where you're going to be planting is very important. If you're going to be gardening in the ground, the most important thing is understanding your soil.
Mm-hmm. And talk about that. What are the things to understand about soil?
We see every kind of soil type there is across the state of Wisconsin. And so we have so many different soils to consider. Sometimes you can tell by what's growing there now what kind of soil you have. It's a great idea to just go out and dig around in the soil, though, and see what it feels like. You can certainly collect soil samples and send them in to the UW-Madison Plant and Soil Analysis Laboratory. For $15, you can get a basic analysis, and you can learn some really important things about your soil. For one, you can learn what the pH is, and pH is the acidity of your soil or the alkalinity of your soil.
And why is that important?
That can dictate what will grow there and what won't. A lot of our vegetable plants, for example, are very neutral and they're not that particular. But there are some plants that are very particular about pH. So if you think you're going to be growing blueberries, for example.
That's the one I always think of.
And you have my soil, which is a lovely pH 8.0.
Which means what?
Very alkaline. So 7.0 is neutral. And it's like the earthquake scale. You know, it's huge.
Right.
So the difference between 7 and 8 is enormous. And so 8 is, there's no way I could ever acidify my soil enough to grow a blueberry.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you need to, if you're investing in shrubs and trees, knowing that pH is really crucial. If you're planting perennials or annuals or vegetables, you can get by with not knowing the pH because a lot of them are pretty forgiving. But some of them are very pH sensitive. So if you've had failures in the past, it may simply be that you are not selecting the proper plants for your location. And so that's really important to understand your soil.
And I think that's a hard thing for probably any gardener to go into that kind of zen mode of, I'm not going to try to make the garden grow what I want it to grow. I'm going to follow the lead of the garden.
Exactly. And that's hard. That's really hard for me. I push the limits all the time to see what I can get to grow in my pH 8.0 soil.
And I think that makes sense, but it's kind of, you know, the definition of insanity is trying the same thing over and over and expecting different results. You know, if it doesn't work for a few years, probably time to move on.
I don't plant azaleas anymore. Azaleas, no, it's funny though, because I have a rhododendron in my yard that was planted by the previous owners, and it's still alive.
Mm, wow.
Which is amazing to me that it has survived. I think it just must be a mutant.
Well, and Patty, you talked about going out and actually, you know, to get a sense of your soil, feeling it. But what are we feeling for?
Well, feeling the soil is really helpful. And in the spring, I recommend people feel their soil all the time, whether they know what kind of soil they have or not, because once we start getting warm days, people think they can go out and plant tomatoes. And knowing the temperature of your soil is crucial, because warm season plants like tomatoes and peppers and eggplant do not like cold soil. And if you put your hand down in the soil 3, 4, or 5 inches deep and it is uncomfortably cool to you, the plant is really not going to like that.
Nobody likes having cold feet.
No. And it can seriously stunt plants and can do a lot of damage that will be very long lasting. So you need to wait until the soil warms up. You can, of course, buy a soil thermometer to measure your temperature, but putting your hands in the soil is very telling. The other thing that you can tell is the consistency of your soil. So if you take a handful of moist soil and rub it through your fingers, you can get kind of an idea of whether or not your soil is heavy clay. If you can pinch the soil between your fingers and make a ribbon out of it, where the soil really sticks together and it feels sticky and it stays together, then you have a lot of clay in your soil. If it feels really gritty, you may have a sandier soil. If you're blessed with loamy soil, where, you know, you've got a nice mixture of silt, clay, and sand, and it feels really loose and friable, you're totally blessed and you should just plant immediately.
Plant everything and anything.
Yes. It's fabulous.
And so we're out there, we're feeling the dirt. How do we know what amendments to add to it to make it really as healthy the soil as we can?
This is actually a pretty easy question to answer without even knowing what kind of soil you have. Compost will always improve your soil, no matter what kind of soil you have. If you have a sandy soil, one that drains very quickly and stays dry, compost will help increase your nutrient and water holding capacity. So it really improves the soil in that way. But compost is pure organic matter, and so it needs to be added every year. You need to be adding that on a regular basis. If your soil is really heavy clay and maybe you have a problem with compaction, where it feels hard and compact when it gets dry, or when it gets wet, it holds water for way too long. Compost helps that also, because it helps to loosen up those clay particles. It helps to provide more aeration in the soil. It helps to improve drainage. So having increased organic matter is really helpful.
And one of the last big components, I think, for gardening is water.
Yes.
How do we know how much water and how often and how long?
Depends a lot on what you're planting. So it goes back to knowing your site, knowing your water availability, you know, understanding your soil and how quickly it drains, watching the weather. So for many gardens, I have gardens in my yard that I don't water. I have a rain garden planted all with native species. I don't water it. It takes care of itself.
Wow.
Even during the most severe drought and heat, it's fine.
That's
so
amazing.
I don't water it. But my vegetable garden, if I were to treat my vegetables that way, I would not be able to harvest anything.
Right. So you'd have a nice compost pile.
I know that in my vegetable gardens, in my raised beds, that, you know, I've got a lot of compost in there. It's very well drained. I need to water those at least once a week during a drought. Container gardens sometimes will have to be watered every day.
Especially if it's something like tomatoes that are already a heavy feeder.
Yes, and later in the season, you know, it might be a twice a day thing for some of those really large plants mm-hmm. that are in containers. So it's watching and learning. And, you know, the nice thing is if you make a mistake, sometimes plants are very forgiving. Sometimes they're not. But you can always replant.
We are talking with Patty Nagai. She is the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County, spending time with us today on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. You can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Next week on Garden Talk, Ed Lyon from Allen Centennial Gardens on the UW-Madison campus is here. He'll share advice on having specialty gardens, even if you don't have acres to work with. That's next week on Garden Talk. But right now, we're getting great information from UW Extension Horticulture Educator Patty Nagai about gardening basics and more. And Patty, we have some folks who would like to join the conversation. So let's go to the phone. And Bob in Oak Park, Illinois. Hi, Bob.
Hello, thank you.
Sure.
I've got a question about Virginia bluebells. Mm-hmm. I was considering putting some in my garden or in my yard in the shady part and was wondering if they're easy to germinate from seed or should I just go ahead and buy some plants?
Well, I suppose it depends on how immediate you want your gratification for bluebells. They actually germinate pretty easy. If you are to plant them in your shady area, they do like moisture. So you need to make sure that they are in a moist, shady area. They do propagate by themselves fairly well if they're in a happy location. So, you know, you could do a combination of things. You could buy a few plants. They are not that expensive. And this time of year, you might be able to find a number of different nonprofit organizations that are doing like native plant mm-hmm. sales. And in your area, I'm not sure in your area, I know they have a huge one up in the Kenosha area, Wild Ones chapter of the Southeast Wisconsin does a big plant sale. And I'm pretty sure you can get bluebells through them. So you can get the plants, you know, you can get a fairly decent sized plant sometimes for just a few dollars. So they're not that expensive.
And they spread or they?
They do spread. Yeah. They do spread.
So you don't necessarily have to fill in the whole
right.
area.
Right. If they're happy, they spread. So as I mentioned, you could do a combination. You could buy, you know, a dozen plants. You could get a package of seeds and intersperse the seeds amongst the where you're planting them. But if they're in a happy location, they will spread and spread and spread and spread, and you will have lots of bluebells.
And I'm guessing Bob knows this because he's actually seeking out Virginia bluebells, but for people that might not be familiar with them, they're actually spring ephemerals, right? So
right.
they pretty much disappear after
right.
blooming.
And exactly. They bloom beautifully, and they bring you that nice color very early on in the lush green of their leaves, the blue flowers, and then they sort of go away. So, and that's a really good point, Judith. You probably, Bob, would want to consider planting other flowers in between them that will give you some later color or coverage. Canadian ginger, the Canada ginger, the native species mm-hmm. of ginger, is a beautiful ground cover. Mayapple is another possibility. Jack in the Pulpit, also. If you have a happy place for Virginia bluebells, all of those would do well there as also. And even trillium, if you can find some trillium. That one I would recommend planting from plants.
And it sounds like from what the other plants you're talking about, it's mainly a shady or at least not a direct sunlight.
Right. He did say it was a shady site. He didn't say whether or not it was a moist site. And the things that I'm talking about prefer a moist shade. Mm-hmm. And there is a huge difference in the native wildflowers, those woodland flowers, which ones will grow in moist shade and which ones will grow in dry shade.
Mm. I love woodland flowers.
I do too.
I'm a big fan. Well, thanks for that call, Bob. And let's go next to Lynette in Madison. Hi, Lynette.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I've acquired a potted hyacinth, I think it is, mm-hmm. a purple.
Uh-huh.
So I'm wondering how to transfer that to my garden and when, because like all the purple leaves have died
The flower has already faded.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, the the problem with doing this, I'm gonna be somewhat negative about this. Not that I'm telling you not to do it, because I generally do this too with very little success. But when you have a potted bulb plant, whether it's daffodils or tulips or the hyacinths, and they're often used by florists, they're wonderful to have in your house. And when they're potted like that, they tend to last a little bit longer, you know, than cut flowers. So there are definite advantages to having those potted plants in your house. Unfortunately, the bulb doesn't generally get what it needs to survive from that pot, from the soil, the nutrients, the watering regime in a container. They don't generally get enough. Now, I'm not telling you not to do it. I would do it and hope for the best. But now would be the time to do it. And of course, you can't do it now because the ground is frozen. So in lieu of that, if you really want to save it and try to keep it going, it needs to not just be watered, but it needs to be fertilized on a regular basis. And that green foliage, you need to try and have it remain green for as long as possible so that the bulb can continue to develop those storage carbohydrates that help it to survive. So what, you know, the bulb just uses up all of its reserves, and it spends so much energy flowering. And then if it's not in a really sunny location and able to mine a lot of nutrients from the soil around it, to put those nutrients back into the bulb. And if the foliage is not green for a long enough period of time to make all of those storage carbohydrates to put back into the bulb, then it just won't survive the next year. So I have been known to just put them into my compost pile, but I have tried planting them as well. So you could try when the weather's permissive, but in the meantime, try to grow it like a houseplant and make sure it gets some fertilizer.
So some kind of general houseplant fertilizer would work.
Right, because at this point you're not so concerned about flowering. It's already flowered. It's not going to flower again. What you're concerned about is maintaining that really nice green foliage. And so just a general 10-10-10 or 20-20-20 type of a houseplant fertilizer would be fine. Right. And keep it in the sun so that it can keep photosynthesizing.
There you go. Thanks for that call, Lynette. Let's go next to Bill in Glendale. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I have a question. I have, I've been mostly taking out lawn and putting in native prairie plants and woodland.
Mm-hmm.
And the lawn I still have, I have our joyous creeping Charlie.
Oh, isn't
and
it?
I'm concerned that if it gets into, I mean, is it going to strangle out my the rest of my plants if it gets to them? And what in heaven's name can anybody do with these things?
Creeping Charlie is the bane of every gardener. I mean, it's just, it's so aggressive. Native plants, however, are very aggressive as well. And once they're firmly established, I have not gotten it into any of my native plant areas. Where I have it is sort of on the edges of my yard under my trees where the grass is not growing so
it's
great
just waiting.
Anyway. It's just like, yeah, but you know, if you don't do anything about it, it just keeps spreading
right.
And spreading and spreading. And it of course will get into perennial planting. So I have no doubt that it would get into a native planting, but I'm not sure how aggressive it would be there. So Creeping Charlie grows, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, it's also called ground ivy. And it was introduced into this country as a ground cover and also as a hanging plant ornamental. And you can still find it in hanging plants today in the variegated form.
Really?
Absolutely.
Wow.
They call it glaucoma, which is its scientific name. So they don't call it Creeping Charlie because who would buy such a hanging basket right. with Creeping Charlie in it? It's a pretty little plant. There are times when I tell people just to learn to love it because if they're not willing to use chemicals, chances are they're not going to be able to get rid of it. You can hand pull it forever. You can go out there and dig and hand pull and hand pull and hand pull. And it's very unlikely that you will ever get it all because it's so voracious in its spreading habits. Every little tiny piece of it can become another plant.
Well, that's the thing, because every couple inches, there's another little root. I don't know.
It roots from everything. Yeah. It just roots like crazy. And then it also has those beautiful little purple flowers that make seed. So, you know, if you leave any piece of it, whether it's a root or a stem piece or seeds, you know, if it's ever flowered, it's there. And so, you know, if you're really intent on getting rid of it, chemicals are about the only way to go, and you have to be really persistent. So what Extension recommends are choosing a one of the combination broadleaf weed killers, and there are many of them on the market that have at least three different herbicides in them. And they also will they many times will have tri in their name, but names are so misleading. You really have to read the label and see what's in there. So at least three different chemicals. And then the time to apply is when they are flowering in the spring. So that's the first time that they are sensitive to these chemicals. And then the second time, which is actually the better time, is after the first heavy frost in the fall.
Okay.
So you may find some lawn care companies who would like to, you know, come in and spray with different things throughout the summer. And just by brute force, they sometimes will be able to get rid of it for you using a number of different chemicals every time. But it's a huge chemical input. And we found that if you're good about doing those two applications, you can get rid of it. Alternatively, if you're ready to get rid of everything in that area, you can use a product that contains glyphosate, which is a total vegetation killer. But of course, that will kill everything.
Right.
And we have found, even with glyphosate, that it sometimes takes two applications to completely eradicate the creeping Charlie. And of course, it will eradicate everything else also. It'll kill your grass or whatever else is there. So it's quite an undertaking to take care of creeping Charlie once it gets established.
Wow. Well, good luck with that, Bill.
I'm sorry. I feel like I'm on this depressing side of gardening. We need a happy question.
Well, let's go to Ray in Rhinelander. Maybe Ray can cheer us up. Hi, Ray.
Hi.
Hi.
Once again, it's very nice to have this person on. She really helps with information, and we all appreciate her. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Could you write a letter to my boss and say that, please?
Well, I'm very good at the art of good making things happen. So, yeah, okay.
Thank you.
Anyways, I have a question about regional planting. And I have made mistakes with that because up in Rhinelander here, it's totally different than Madison with a variety of things, as you know, especially 24 below zero, but we're done with that. But butterfly gardens.
Yes.
There was a special on about some of the different butterflies where their numbers are going down, like the monarchs and things like that. Mm-hmm. So what I want to do is look at regionally what I can plant here for my butterfly gardens. And is there a book or something online? I'm looking for an updated reference to this because there's a lot of stuff out there, but it's like from 10 years ago, five years ago, further. So that's what I need help with. And I'll take this off the air.
All right. Thanks, Ray.
Thank you, Ray. And your kind comments are much appreciated. And butterfly gardens. And you gave us a happy subject to talk about.
Yes.
So I love that as well. You know, the butterflies are in trouble for a lot of different reasons. And in some cases, it's because of just the weather patterns. And last year, for example, we were very late getting started with the butterfly migration, and they got up here and they were off cycle a little bit. And they normally have, monarchs have, I think, three generations that they go through in Wisconsin. And we are a primary feeding site and reproductive site for them, you know, all the way across the Midwest and the Upper Plains. It's a very popular place for them to come spend their summers. So they need food, and they need nectar plants. They need food for their larvae. And for the monarchs, of course, it's the milkweed. And milkweed populations are down because of cropping, the way our agricultural communities have done their cropping and their clearing of the land. We don't have as much natural milkweed planted as we used to. But there are a lot of different factors that go into those monarch populations, but they are very low. We're hoping for a better year this year. And there are some things that individuals can do. Milkweed, of course, is the food for their larvae. But if you want to plant a butterfly garden to attract a lot of different types of butterflies and other pollinators, You need to look at some of the native plants that are specific to your area, and they need to be plants that produce flowers, of course, at the right time and over the entire season. So it's not just the spring flowers, it's not just the summer flowers, it's not just the fall flowers. It's the entire growing season. And Rhinelander is, of course, very different from where I live. But I believe you can go onto one of the Monarch websites and be able to find plant lists for different zones. And so I'm assuming you're like zone 3. There are a lot of different of our native butterfly plants that will grow in zone 3. But I would recommend that you go to those Monarch websites and download a butterfly plant list. The other place you could go is one of our Wisconsin nurseries who provide seeds and plants for butterfly gardens. And they would be able to make sure that you're getting the right ones for your zone as well. So some of those companies, and if I exclude somebody, I'm sorry, it's just what's on the top of my head. Of course, there's Prairie Nursery and there's Agricole and Judith, do you know any others off the top of your
head? Prairie was the one that popped into my head. But I think if anyone Googles native Wisconsin plants,
in fact, you can do Wisconsin nursery. You could add zone 3 to your Google search, and you should be able to get a good list from them for things that will do well, not just in your zone, but in your soil type.
Right.
And that's really critical for those native plants also. In addition to native plants, there are a lot of cultivated varieties of native plants that can be used to attract butterflies. Of course, there are many different types of coneflowers and asters. Some of the more cultivated varieties may have some better characteristics for your particular yard. Maybe they're shorter or a different color or something. But there are so many different plants that you can put into a butterfly garden. And then also consider the feeding habits of the larvae, you know, for the other types of butterflies. So things like fennel and parsley, very important to put into a butterfly garden in addition to those flowering plants that they use for nectar.
And I have to say, my front lawn is naturalized coneflowers. It's not a big lawn by any means, but naturalized coneflowers. And, you know, at the height of the summer, there are maybe a half dozen different kinds of bees on them and, you know, four or five different kinds of butterflies.
Right. And there are so many different plants that you can choose from and get a beautiful color throughout the season and attract not just butterflies, but all of the different pollinators as well. Because, of course, you know, the bees, we have issues with the bees as well. So it's good to support our local small wildlife.
Help them so they can continue to help us.
Exactly.
Well, we had a caller who wanted to share a Creeping Charlie success story. He said he uses barn lime. He puts it on when the leaves are in rapid growth in the spring, and within 2 weeks it just dies back.
I would be concerned about that because, of course, not everybody's soil could handle that.
And what would lime do to a soil?
It would make it more alkaline.
Okay. So it raises the pH.
Raises the pH, yes. And there are some other things that have come out, you know, like using borax and all sorts of things. And the only problem with that is that everybody's soil is different. And with some of those compounds, you could get to the point where you could make your soil toxic, you know, where nothing would grow.
So
be careful. Yes, please be careful. That would not be an extension recommendation.
Right. We are talking with Patty Nagai. She is the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County, spending time with us today on Garden Talk. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. You can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. You can also send an email to talk@wpr.org. Talking about gardening with Patty Nagai. She is the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County, and she always has great information to share. And she is not alone. There are great horticulture educators all over the state. And you know, we're kind of as a theme, we're talking about, you know, great information for new gardeners. Patty, tell us what kind of resources are available through UW Extension.
We don't have horticulture educators in every county, but we have services available in every county that people can call into their local UW Extension office and find out what their local resource is for getting good quality information and get their questions answered. Many of the counties do have what are called horticulture helplines or master gardener helplines or Those sorts of services available that are available usually during the growing season. In some cases, they're available year-round. In addition, we have a website that's very easy to get to, hort.uwex.edu. And you can post questions to that website, too, and they will be channeled to the appropriate part of the state for an answer. Mm-hmm. So you can put questions in that way.
Again, that's H-O-R-T, like horticulture, mm-hmm. dot U-W-E-X, like UW extension,
right.
dot E-D-U.
For education. And that website is also very easy to navigate. You can just, as a really cool search tool, you can just type in what you're interested in. If you're interested in roses, you can just put roses in the search term and it will pull up all of our fact sheets, publications, information that we have on roses. If you want to be more specific, maybe you're interested in powdery mildew on roses, you can put that in.
And you kind of alluded to it, but the Learning Store is where
right.
a lot of those publications, I mean, several hundred publications.
Right. That's another resource, is going directly to learningstore.uwex.edu, where all of the publications can be found by topic. Mm-hmm. There's also a search feature on there if you know more about what you're looking for. We have a new section on there for urban and community gardens that has all of our new community gardening and composting publications.
Mm,
so there are a lot of things on there. And that's constantly being added to. In fact, just this morning, I was over at Publications doing final proof on our raised bed and container gardening publication. So I'm very excited about that. So that one should be online in a couple of weeks. And then we also have our People Plus Plants website on community gardening, where you can go and see videos. You can watch videos on raised bed gardening, on powdery mildew, insect control in the community garden. And that website's a little bit longer, but it's fyi.uwex.edu/peopleplants.
All right.
And so that's a great website to go to also to learn more about community gardening and to be able to watch videos of gardening.
Wonderful. And let's go back. Actually, you just mentioned raised beds, and we had an email from Kathy. I have a raised bed that is made with treated lumber. Is the soil safe for growing vegetables? It's going to be a labor-intensive project to redo the bed.
Well, it depends on what it's treated with. I'm hoping it's not creosote. If it's creosote, if it's, like railroad timbers, I would say take it down and dispose of those safely, because there is no approved use for anything treated with creosote in a residential property, and certainly not for vegetable gardens. So creosote is a definite no-no. Up until about 10 years ago, we had wood products that were treated with chromium copper arsenate. And so that contains arsenic. That was taken off the market, so it's not really sold for residential use anymore. So hopefully it's not that. The biggest problem with that particular treatment is through touching, not necessarily growing vegetables in it. There is the newer type of treated lumber is just copper, primarily copper. And we have used that for raised beds in the various gardens to show how it works and how well it stands up to time, weathering, and all of that. So that type of treated lumber, it's not that it's not approved for gardening or vegetable gardening. There are some people who are more concerned about that. And so if they use that type of treated lumber, they will line it with plastic to keep anything from migrating into the soil. It's kind of a strange little area of research, because there's so many different factors that can affect whether or not the copper and the chemicals in the wood can get into the soil. The biggest one is the pH of the soil. If your pH is really acidic, you will have a little bit more migration into the soil, and you will have the plants will be able to take it up. Mm. If your soil is alkaline, the chemicals basically just sit there and they don't really get far into the soil, and the plants won't take them up because they cannot take up those kinds of compounds in a more alkaline soil. So this is another area where it would be very helpful to know what the pH of your soil is. I prefer to make raised beds out of things like retaining wall block or cedar, or even that artificial wood that's made of wood and resin, mm-hmm. kind of put together. It's like plastic. It looks like wood, but it's really plastic. They have all sorts of raised bed kits that you can do that. But my very favorite is retaining wall block because it's so permanent. Mm-hmm. And you can sit on the side of the garden
there you go.
While you're gardening.
While you're gardening. Thanks for that email. Let's go back to the phones and Rita in Glenwood City. Hi, Rita.
Hi.
Hi.
I enjoy the show thoroughly. And I got a quick question. I want to know the best process of stratification of seed. And also, if Bells of Ireland is one that has to be stratified.
I have grown Bells of Ireland from seed, and I did not stratify it. I'm trying to think if I really got great germination with it or not. So I'm not sure if it needs to be stratified or not. It probably wouldn't hurt. You know, a lot of those, what originally were wildflower kind of seeds, a lot of them do well with stratification. And stratification is not, for some things it's more tedious than others, but it can be as simple as putting the seeds in a pot with some seed germination mixture, making sure it's moist, putting it in a cold place, bringing it back out to a warm place, putting it back in a cold place, bringing it back out to a warm place. And essentially what you're doing is mimicking nature. And so for a lot of wildflower seeds, they germinate quite well under that cool, warm stratification kind of process. But it's not totally necessary for all of them, but you might get better germination if you do it.
And actually, I would say I was just checking if it was just a week ago, and it was that Neil DeBull was mm-hmm. on from Prairie Nursery, and he talked at length about stratification. I think there's moist and dry
right.
and scarification and all kinds
of
things.
Scarification is when you actually disrupt the seed coat.
Right, you scratch it.
It's because every plant has a different way that they mm-hmm. put their seeds into dormancy. And so mm-hmm. you're trying to break the dormancy.
Right.
You, of course, can look it up. You know, I mean, all of this information is probably online. But if you don't want to do that and you just think about where these plants grow naturally
right.
and think about what they experience during the year, you know, and so some of them are tricky, you know, like if you were trying to grow a jack pine, for example, which we don't grow here. It's the one that comes to mind, though, because it requires fire to germinate.
Wow. So. Well, Rita, if you're interested, you can go back at WPR.org and listen to last week's Garden Talk show with Neil. And actually, I wrote a lot of those tips that mm-hmm. he shared about stratification up as a web story, and you can find that attached
cool.
to that.
Oh, cool. That's a wonderful resource then. So stratification is it's not that difficult, but different species do require different mm-hmm. things.
Mm-hmm. And Bells of Ireland are such an interesting plant because the flowers are actually green,
they're
too.
They're green, and then they're really pretty. I mean, it's a beautiful little plant. But I know I have grown them in the greenhouse. With our Greenworks training class, we've grown Bells of Ireland without using any stratification.
And perfect question for pre-St. Patrick's Day also.
Absolutely.
Thanks for that call,
maybe
Rita.
Maybe if you plant them on St. Patrick's Day, they will be especially beautiful.
It'll be a happy, happy little plant. Let's go next to Steve in Whitewater. Hi, Steve.
Good morning. We purchased a home that has, and the previous owner was quite a gardener and had a large flower and vegetable bed of maybe 6 feet across and 25 or 30 feet long. We are not gardeners, and my vision is that we would take a very small portion of that space and just have some perennials, ornamental flower mm-hmm. grasses, some perennial plants, and then maybe a few annuals around the edges, just as a small focus area. And wondering about how to get from there to where we think we want to go, and wondering whether, you know, the whole area should just be treated with a glyphosate or something and then start from scratch. What's there now is just a combination of some leftover bulbs and herbs and weeds, dandelions, and grass, and so forth.
Weeds, yeah. And you know, herbs can become quite weedy if they're not corralled mm. and maintained.
I had some oregano that was ready to take over the world.
Yeah, you know, a lot of them are in the mint family, and mm-hmm. anything in the mint family can be quite aggressive. So, you know, when you first started, I had this picture of this glorious plot of empty land, you know, just waiting to be planted, but now you've depressed me with all of your weeds and things. you could use an herbicide to get rid of what is there to start over. You could go in and do some manual digging. I mean, it sounds horrible, and I don't, you know, without seeing it, I'm not sure how aggressive you would have to be. But some of those things can be pulled pretty easily. I routinely pull herbs up and discard them. The bulbs, just spraying with glyphosate's not going to do that unless they're actively growing. Glyphosate only works on actively growing green plants, so it doesn't have any effect on what's in the soil. So the bulbs may still come back to haunt you if you're trying to get rid of them. So those would, you might want to dig those out.
Would smothering be another
option? Well, I was gonna get to that point. You know, if you don't want to use something like glyphosate, if you want to, you know, just try and maintain one area as a garden area, there are other ways of doing it. You know, I mean, you could run a lawnmower over and just cut everything back to the ground. I mean, scalp it. If you can pull things out or dig things out to some extent, you know, that would be great. If you cover that area with about 12 to 15 layers of newsprint, and then put a layer of compost on top of that, wet it all down and give it a little bit of time, you can actually get rid of a lot of those things without using any chemicals at all. It's sort of like a modified lasagna or sheet composting kind of method. It works very well to smother out any existing plants.
And it'll just break down, right?
The newspaper eventually just breaks down, and you don't have to till or anything. You just plant right through it. Typically, when I recommend this method, it should be done in the fall with a pretty hefty dose of compost on top. Go into winter nice and moist, and then by the time we can plant in spring, you know, it's ready to plant. But you can do it in the spring also. So if the ground has thawed, which I doubt that it has, but you know, you can do it as soon as the ground thaws. If you try to do it too soon, your ground will take forever to thaw, because essentially what you're doing is putting a big blanket on top
of
frozen soil and insulating it, and it'll stay frozen for a really long time. But it's, you know, there's so many different things that you could do with that area. If it had already been gardened in previous years, you know, it could be that it's fabulous soil and it really doesn't need that much work to plant. But what I would recommend is that you kind of plot it out, and you can do that right now while there's snow on the ground. Kind of draw out what you want and come up with some ideas of how you want it to look, mm-hmm. you know, and how, whether you want height, color, long season interest. The idea of putting in some of those ornamental grasses is a great one, because that gives you a nice vertical, a really sturdy vertical to put like at the back of the garden. Mm-hmm. Draw it all out, and you know, you could take your drawing into your local master gardener volunteers at the county extension office, and they could help you and give you some advice on what you're planning to make sure that you make some good decisions for plants.
There you go. Good luck with that, Steve. Let's go next to Beverly in Rushford. Hi, Beverly.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I am a defender of Creeping Charlie. And I really feel it has been victimized.
It has.
By time. The time has come each year that something new is added, and you have to replace
right.
that nasty Creeping Charlie. And you and Creeping Charlie has so many beautiful things about it.
It is a beautiful little plant. I do not deny that.
And I, you know, it stands up to air pollution. You can't, you just, it's courageous.
It's very courageous.
And it really is. It stands up to air pollution, and it conquers poor soil conditions.
It grows really well in poor soil. You are absolutely right.
So I just feel it's been victimized, and yeah. I feel that if you don't like where it's growing, what you just explained about the smothering it with the different areas, you can, but it takes control.
Yes.
And if you don't control it or want to control it, it is really beautiful. And
it is.
My goodness, it certainly has filled my every need.
Oh, well, Beverly, thank you for that.
And look, there's a plant for everyone.
And I was actually telling Patty that when we bought our house, there was Creeping Charlie all over, and I had never seen it before. And I thought, what a lovely little plant, the little delicate flowers, beautiful little purple, until I was hoping to plant anything else. Right. And it was really, as Beverly said, it's
aggressive. It's courageous.
It's courageous.
Yes, it's very courageous. And it will grow. In many cases, it'll grow where nothing else will grow.
Right.
It's
and
true.
So there's that. And on the same theme, Barb from Wausau emailed, Creeping Charlie is a great early spring nectar source for honeybees. So are dandelions. There is more to enjoy about a less than perfect lawn.
Absolutely. I agree with that completely. And I have a little boy who if I'm going to get rid of a dandelion, I have to do it when he's not around. Because he thinks they're fabulous. Well, he'll bring me a bouquet of dandelions.
Some year, maybe this year, I'm going to remember to go out when the dandelions first come up, because the leaves are actually
delicious. The leaves are very edible. There are cultivated varieties of dandelion that are grown for food in other countries. You know, we in the United States don't appreciate the glories of the dandelion. Other people who come to our country see the dandelion in bloom and wonder why in the world we would ever want to kill it. Right. But in other countries, it's edible. So absolutely.
There you go. Patty Nagai is our guest on Garden Talk. She is the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County. She and her fellow horticulture educators are always a great resource for us. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller on Garden Talk. Larry is in Hawaii with a group of Wisconsin Public Radio listeners, and there are photos up from their trip. You can get to those by going to WPR.org and going to the Larry Mueller Show Larry Mueller Show page, and there is a link to those photos. It looks like they're having a wonderful time. Again, Judith Sears Poisson. Growing plants, whether indoors or out, really helps connect us with nature. And as spring starts to show itself, I can just feel gardeners all over the state itching to get out and play in the dirt. Hi, I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Good to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for Garden Talk. Patty Nagai is the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County and always has lots of great information to share, and she's sharing that with us right now. Patty, thanks again for spending time with us.
Oh, you're welcome. It's my pleasure.
And you can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email at talk@wpr.org or post a question, comment, or garden photo on our Facebook page. That's the Larry Mueller Show. Let's go to Monica in Green Bay right away. She's been waiting to join in. Hi, Monica.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is about barberry shrubs.
Mm-hmm.
I have three of them that are really overgrown, and I'm wondering if I can prune them down almost to the ground at this time of year and have them grow in a nicer shape in the spring when they start to bloom or come up.
Well, you know, once you get into the really mature growth on some of those shrubs, they don't necessarily like to be pruned all the way back to the ground. Some things can handle it that send up suckers every year, but barberry is not a suckering plant. And there are those who would say, don't just cut them back to the ground, remove them completely.
Now, is barberry is it thorny?
It's thorny. They come in different colors. Okay. There are cultivars that are kind of a burgundy red, and there are barberries that are bright yellowy green. Mm-hmm. But they are on the DNR invasive species list.
Really?
They are. And they can be quite detrimental to some of our natural wildlife areas, so they are not recommended for planting anymore. Now, that doesn't mean that you have to rip them out and plant something else, but honestly, if you're not happy with the way that they look, and if you're considering just cutting them down to try and get them to grow into a better shape, eventually they will get back into that shape you don't like. And so, you know, it might be time to think about replacing them with a more acceptable and friendlier shrub, because barberries also are not very friendly.
Right. Very pokey. We had them alongside the house when I was growing up, right. And I have memories of accidentally falling into them, and it's not a pleasant experience.
It's very unpleasant, yeah.
Monica, if you're interested in replacing them, what kind of conditions is it? Maybe Patty can suggest something.
Well, it's full sun. Mm-hmm. It's close to the house where they are.
Right.
And I need something that is not very tall, mm-hmm. You know, when it's full grown, probably 3 feet or less.
Right. Do you know much about your soil conditions?
It's pretty sandy.
Is it? Well, there might be a lot of different things that, you know, a lot of the boxwoods are very nice. They don't flower per se. I mean, it's not known for its flowering, but they're a nice little shrub, and there are some really cool cultivars that... they're broadleaf evergreens, and so they hold on to their leaves throughout the winter. So they make a really nice front of the house kind of a shrub. But just for their foliage, they're a beautiful bright green. They're very pretty. There's also like a birchleaf spirea. The other spireas I'm not that fond of, but the birchleaf spirea is really pretty. If you're looking for a flowering shrub, something with some color, there are some dwarf hydrangeas that are just gorgeous, that are quite striking on the front of the house, but you will have to look at the height carefully, because some of them get very large and some of them stay quite neat and tidy and very short. So those are just a few suggestions. If you're ready to get rid of your barberry, the DNR would be happy with you if you got rid of them.
Well, I might be happy to get rid of them too. I'm getting awfully tired of getting scraped up when I try to prune them.
Yes, and boxwood are so soft and gentle.
There you go. We kinder, gentler gardening.
A kinder, gentler shrub, yes.
Well, good luck with that, Monica. And if you do replace them, send us a picture of what you put in. We'd love to see it. Dan in Coloma is up next. Hi, Dan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a pasture that was a horse pasture, about an acre in size. Horses are gone. Last year it overgrew with motherwort, unbelievably so. And I'd like to turn it back over to prairie if I can, and maybe a lot of flowers. I keep bees also a little bit as a hobby.
Right.
How can I get rid of or start this over?
How big of an area is it?
It's about an acre.
Oh, wow. That's a Neil DeBolt question. you know, when people are redoing large areas like that into prairie, there are a number of different methods that you can use to plant and to transition over. Some of them do involve using chemicals. Some of them involve turning the soil on multiple occasions to try and get rid of some of the weed seeds that are going to be in the soil. But in general, you know, if you've had kind of a weedy pasture for a number of years, the seed bank is going to be huge for weed seeds. It's just going to be a very intensive gardening undertaking for the next few years. So there's some education and training that's going to be necessary for you to manage that property and get it into prairie. And going through one of our, you know, we have a lot of companies within Wisconsin who do this as a business, and it may be something that you would want to hire out, at least initially, and then learn more yourself about how to identify the native plants versus the weed seedlings, because controlling what comes up will be, you know, the success or failure of your project. So many prairies die a very unhappy death because there's so many weed seeds in the soil that are, just face it, weeds are weeds because they compete so aggressively, and they germinate so rapidly, and they grow so quickly, and they grow really early in the season when other things are still waiting for warmer temperatures. And so there's some education that you're going to need to undertake in order to manage the soil property properly. But I would, you know, for a plot that size, I would recommend that you go speak with some of these firms that do this for a business.
Mm-hmm. Good luck with that, Dan. And we had a question from Meredith on Facebook. She has a perennial garden, which includes a couple of knockout roses. She says she's thinking she would like to move them to a different location to allow her to concentrate more on those native perennials in that specific area. She wonders if she can move them in the spring without harming them, and if so, any tips? The bushes have been where they are for about 5 years and have done well. The new location she has in mind has plenty of sun and should be equally good.
You can move roses in the spring. It's a little easier to move them in the fall for obvious reasons. The ground is a little bit more amenable to being dug in the fall, but they can be moved in the spring. You know, the key to success is to make sure that where you're moving them is ready for them. So if you're going to do any kind of compost addition or any kind of soil amendments, that you have that all ready to go. You have your holes dug. You said you have full sun. That's great. When you dig them, try to retain as much of a root ball as possible. You don't want to break up the roots. You want to get as much of them as you can. And that's sometimes difficult, even in a relatively small plant like a mm-hmm. rose bush. Try to get as much of the roots as possible. Transfer them immediately to the new hole. Make sure you don't plant them too deeply. You don't want to plant them any deeper than they were in their previous location. So you have to allow for a little bit of settling. So sometimes people will plant them a little bit high. Make sure that your hole gets filled in properly. They get watered right away. And then keep an eye on them to make sure that they stay nice and moist during that transition period. They may be a little bit stunted this year, but they should be fine.
And so perhaps they wouldn't flower this year? Or
no, I think they will flower because knockouts are pretty amazing. I think they will flower. If you haven't pruned your roses back, when you move roses, it's a great time to cut them back a little bit. And if you've seen any dieback from winter, you'd want to make sure that you cut back any dead branches during that time too.
We are talking with Patty Nagai. She is the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller on Garden Talk. And you can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. We had another transplant question, this one from Sharon in Minocqua, and she wonders if it's possible to transplant crab apple trees.
It depends on how big they are. Crab apples are a little bit more difficult to transplant, of course, because they're a tree and they have a pretty good sized root system. If it is a small, fairly young tree, yes. If it's an older tree, and by an older tree, if it's been in place for more than, you know, 7-8 years, I wouldn't even attempt it. I would choose one of the new scab resistant, beautiful cultivars and purchase a new tree for your other location. They send out some pretty significant root systems, and you're going to do a tremendous amount of damage when you transplant it.
All right. Let's go back to the phones and Jay in Milwaukee. Hi, Jay.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two main questions, I guess. The first is I live in an apartment with a deck that has a southern exposure, so it gets sun all day, and I would like to grow a tomato and maybe a cucumber.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering what you meant by container gardening. Is that just a pot, or what exactly that entails?
Sure.
Oh, a container can be almost anything. Anything that will hold soil and have drainage can be used as a container as long as it has not been used for something nasty, you know. So you need to know what your container was used for. So if you're just grabbing a 5-gallon bucket, if it's a food grade 5-gallon bucket, something that was used for pickles or some enormous quantity of mayonnaise or something like that, those are fine. Whiskey barrels, half wine barrels, those are fabulous for containers. Or you can purchase a large plastic pot. You know, they come in all sizes, and you can get those plastic containers that look like terracotta but aren't. You know, they're very inexpensive, and you can get them up to like 24 inches in diameter, really large things. So anything that can hold soil, has drainage holes in the bottom, and is not toxic can be used as a container. For a tomato plant, the bigger the container, the better off you will be. And you need to very carefully select your your tomato cultivar to make sure that it will grow well in a container. So there are a lot of cultivars of tomatoes that are specific, tomatoes that are specifically for containers. So some examples of that are, there's one called Container Tomato Superbush, which makes a really thick stem and kind of holds itself up, makes a medium-sized tomato. Early Girl is a determinate type of tomato that doesn't get so huge and can be grown very well in a container.
And determinate means that it's
determinate means that it won't get very tall.
Right.
So do not select any tomato cultivars that are indeterminate, which means they will grow on and on forever, because it will be really difficult to keep them in check, and you would have to have some sort of enormous support system for them, because they will need mm-hmm. trellising mm-hmm. and they typically get, you know, 6 to 20 feet tall. So you want to avoid the indeterminate types of tomatoes and go for the ones that are for, specifically for containers. There are some small cherry and grape types of tomatoes that are perfect for containers, like Lozano or Tumbling Tom. But don't pick something like Super Sweet 100 or Yellow Pear, which are also cherry type tomatoes, because they are indeterminate plant types and they get too big for a container.
And they just won't perform well.
They won't perform as well as they would in the ground. And so try to select a determinate plant type that ideally says that it's good for containers, because there are some newer cultivars that are specifically bred for container-grown plants.
And cucumbers?
There are also container cultivars of cucumber that have smaller plant types. But with the cucumbers, a lot of them you can grow in containers as long as you provide a nice trellis for them. And if your pot is big enough, you can grow the tomato and the cucumber in the same container. Mm. So that is also possible. You could throw some maybe a couple of little basil plants and cilantro plants in the front of it, or put some pansies in there, or a petunia, something that'll hang over the pot and make it pretty.
Very nice. Sounds like a great project, Jay. Let's go to Holly in Madison. Hi, Holly.
Hi.
Hi.
I have another transplant question. I have a big hardy hibiscus mm-hmm. in my backyard, and it gets about 6 feet tall. And I'm wondering if I can, I'm moving and I want to take it with me. I don't want to if it's going to kill it, but I just don't know anything about it, if I can transplant that or not, and when I could do it.
Do you know which kind of hibiscus it is? Is it the one they call Rose of Sharon that does not die back, or is it the hardy, more of a tropical looking hibiscus that dies back to the ground?
It dies back to the ground.
Okay. So those, you have a better chance of taking that with you. It is possible, because they do die back in the spring. Again, though, you need to try and get as much of the root system as possible and make sure that during transport it stays moist. So the good news is that you can dig those. I don't know when you're moving, but you can dig those as soon as you're able and containerize it. You know, find a really large pot to put it in, so that it has something to hold its root system together. Keep it moist, but not overly wet. So the good news is those don't typically come out until the temperatures get super warm. And so I have several of those tropical looking hardy hibiscus, and I typically don't get buds and shoots coming out of them until the first or second week of June.
That's how Rose of Sharon are too. I would always think they were dead. And then all
yeah,
of a sudden
they
come back.
Yeah, but the Rose of Sharon doesn't die back completely.
Right, right.
These guys die back to the ground. So they're in some ways much easier to move
right.
than a Rose of Sharon. And they're not quite as vigorous as a Rose of Sharon. You know, the Rose of Sharon, those can get enormous. Those can get 15 feet tall and multiple branches and all of that. So I would say it's worth a try. If it doesn't work, you can always visit your local garden center or nursery and buy another one.
Thanks for that call. Let's go to Mike in Oshkosh. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
Hi.
Two questions. Has your guest ever heard of a veg trug?
A veg trug?
T-R-U-G, I believe it is. V-E-G-T-R-U-G.
Is that the plastic tub kind of container?
No, it's a long trough type thing.
It's a trough.
Vine Gardens has them.
I know what you're talking about. Yeah, I was thinking more along the lines of a smaller kind of container, but I have this picture in my head. Yes.
Okay. Could you grow potatoes in something like that?
You can grow potatoes in almost anything. Potatoes are really funny. Sharon Morrissey, the extension educator in Milwaukee County, grows them in all sorts of interesting plastic containers. And some years she's had really good success, and other years, you know, not so much. I think some of it is weather dependent more so than the container. So the thing about growing potatoes in containers is that the potato, you can start the container very deep in the container, and you know, just cover it loosely with your soil. And then when you start seeing the shoots coming up out of the little potato pieces, then you add some more soil or compost or soil compost blend, and you can just keep adding soil. So the potatoes will be very deep in the container. And as you're progressing through the year, you're adding more soil or soil compost mix until the vines get to the top of the container, and then you let it grow and completely develop until the end of the season when the vines start to die back. And what you'll find is that you'll get potatoes forming all up and down the stem tissue that's under the soil in the container. And so that's the way to maximize production in a container, growing potatoes. But yes, you can do that. Potatoes are actually pretty easy to grow in all sorts of containers, and can be quite productive if you have a really good soil mix. And so the soil mix is important to make sure that it's high organic matter and very well drained, so you don't want them to rot.
And actually, I know that potatoes are supposed to do very well with the straw bale gardening technique.
Yes, I have tried other things in the straw bale, not the potatoes, but I would imagine they would grow really well because it's a nice, organic, well-drained, aerified kind of environment, and that's how potatoes develop the best. But you have to remember that potatoes are not root tissue. They are stem tissue. Mm-hmm. And so that's where you're going to get the bulk of your potatoes being produced from, are those stems that are underground.
And they stay clean. Yes. In the straw bale. We had a couple of follow-ups. Jim in New Auburn had a barberry follow-up. He said in addition to it being an invasive, it was reported by the Department of Natural Resources that they seem to provide a desirable habitat for deer ticks with Lyme disease.
So, another reason to get rid of the barberry.
And
yes,
we were also going to do a quick clear-up on the oxalis shamrock.
Yes, I got ahead of myself. And just for those people who think that I know everything, I don't. And I make mistakes just like everybody else. So oxalis is not in the same family with the other trifoliate leafed things like alfalfa and beans and things. So it's not a legume at all. But I think my fertilizer recommendation would still stay the same because it's a flowering plant. And so with flowering plants, you want to make sure that you don't over-fertilize with nitrogen. And with any containerized plant, you know, fertilizer is going to be important because there are only limited resources in any container. And so right, if you're growing oxalis as a house plant, you will need to fertilize it.
And a caller wanted to point out that there are native jack pines in Iowa County.
I did not know that.
So don't you just love how our callers help us out?
Wow, I thought you had to go much further west to get into the jack pine country. That's exciting.
Well,
I might have to go to Iowa County.
There you go. Little field trip. So Patty, in just the last 30 seconds or so, why don't you give that general website for horticulture at UW Extension?
Sure, again. I'd be happy to. So the UW Extension horticulture team has a website for the public, and it's hort.uwex.edu, and there you can find information on all sorts of plants, vegetables, lawns, trees, shrubs, flowers, houseplants, diseases, insects. It's all right there at your fingertips. We do have a lot of the publications there as well that you can find on the Learning Store, but the Hort site has all the fact sheets, the publications, and other resources that you might find useful.
Great. Patty Nagai, thank you so much for spending time with us, as always.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks, Judith.
And coming up Monday at 11, physical therapists Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne-Brody share advice for spring training, not talking about professional baseball players, but for the rest of us, how to get active in the spring without risking injury. And coming up next week on Garden Talk, Ed Lyon from Allen Centennial Gardens will be here. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us today for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network.